I'd like to turn for a few minutes this evening to 1 John and chapter 3 and the first three verses of that chapter. So 1 John chapter 3 verses 1 to 3. I shall just begin obviously by reading that passage. John writes, "See what kind of love the Father has given to us, that we should be called children of God. And so we are. The reason why the world does not know us is that it did not know him. Beloved, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared. But we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, because we shall see him as he is. And everyone who thus hopes in him purifies himself as he is pure." So we've heard Philip talking to us this evening about the fact that he is a Christian. And we thought a little bit this morning about some of the marks of a true Christian. And this evening we're going to look at a few other realities about the Christian man, the Christian woman, the Christian child. And so several points then that John has for us here in these verses. First of all, notice with me the Christian's dignity. The Christian's dignity. Now it's crucial to remind ourselves at the outset, of course, that there is a dignity which belongs to every single human being. The dignity of being made, the Bible tells us, in God's very image. There is a certain God-likeness about human beings that is not there in any other of God's creatures. And as I say then, this is a crucial, a foundational biblical truth. It's impossible really to overestimate its importance. We must be absolutely clear on this, that from the dementia-ridden geriatric to the fragile unborn child, from the down-and-out addicted to heroin, to the Islamic State terrorist, from the ancestor worshipper in China, to the unclothed tribesman in the Amazonian rainforest, every single human being on planet Earth is made in the image of God and possesses then that very real and very vital dignity. But that said, that's not, of course, what John is talking about here. The Christian's dignity, then, is even higher than that. Yes, there is a dignity that all human beings possess, and that is significant. But there's an even higher dignity which the Christian possesses. The Christian is not merely God's image bearer. The Christian, John tells us, is God's child. That's the truth that's been brought out in the opening verse of our passage. And what then is the dignity of being God's child? Well, I suppose we could answer that question in many different ways, couldn't we? We could talk about the rights and the privileges that belong to God's children. The child of God has 24/7 access to the Father. The child of God has this indescribable inheritance lined up for him or her. The child of God is in a family that's so precious, with brothers and sisters all over the world. And so we could go on, and often then the New Testament answers the question in that way. What is the dignity of the child of God? It's having all these rights and privileges which belong to membership of God's family. But here that's not quite the answer John gives. The dignity then of being God's child here is simply being that loved by God. Look at what he says. "See what kind of love the Father has given to us, that we should be called children of God." You see, God didn't need to make us his children. God didn't need more children. Our existence as God's children doesn't fulfill some aching void within God's heart. God had a child. God had a son. A son whom he found infinitely absorbing, endlessly delightful, unfailingly satisfying. A son who was beautiful in his eyes, the apple of his eye. And yet, nonetheless, he goes and extends the borders of his family and makes us also his children. And not only that, of course. In making us his children, in extending the borders of his family to incorporate us, he's really incorporating the most unlikely candidates imaginable, isn't he? Us. People like you and me. Angels incorporated into the family of God is a little bit more comprehensible. But people like us. Katie Hopkins is a somewhat controversial TV personality and journalist, whom some of you may have encountered, and she caused a stir with an article in the Daily Mail a couple of years ago, where she talked about the way in which she polices her children's friendships. And the article began then like this, "Looking at the garish party invitation in my daughter's hand, my heart sank. The venue was bad enough, the dirty, sticky soft play area at our local leisure centre. But the name of the birthday girl told me all I needed to know. With her pierced ears, passion for pink leggings, and array of electronic play equipment, Charmaine is definitely not the sort of child I want my daughter associating with. Pretending to look at my diary, I sighed, oh, what a shame, we're busy on that day. Later on," she continued, "at the risk of sounding snobbish, I also favour children who have good old-fashioned Victorian names, such as George, Henry, and Victoria. And if a child has a name with a Latin or Greek derivation, all the better. It indicates the parents are well educated." And so she went on. Now, you may think that that's outrageous, or you may think that it's very sensible, but my point is not to analyse Katie Hopkins' parenting, but it's simply this, that here's God, and his standards then are infinitely higher than Katie Hopkins' standards. And we're not talking then about who he's going to allow to mix with his children. We're talking about who he is going to actually make his children. And the problem with us then is not simply our pierced ears, pink leggings, and array of electronic gadgets, or even our names. It's our rotten, idolatrous, God-hating, sin-addicted hearts. It's not that we simply hang out in dirty soft plays in leisure centres. It's that we're part of the world, which John has described in chapter 2, verse 16, with its the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and pride in possessions. And yet this God goes and incorporates us into his family. No wonder then, John writes, see what kind of love this is. And by the way, it's easy to miss, isn't it, that we have then in this opening verse of our passage a command. I guess we hear that word, the C word, and we immediately brace ourselves, because we know, don't we, that there are a lot of very rigorous commands in the New Testament scriptures. Commands about loving our enemies and controlling our tongues and treating members of the opposite sex with absolute purity and so on. And so we brace ourselves, but this command actually, it's nothing like those ones. This command is more important than those ones, because this command comes before those other ones. We're not ready actually to obey those more ethical commands until we've obeyed this command that John gives us here. What's John's command? See. Look. Behold. Look at the love that God has lavished on you to make you a child in his family. Reflect on it long and hard. John is saying. Absorb into your thinking the dignity that is yours being this loved by God, that he has extended the borders of his family and brought you into it. Are you obeying this command tonight? If you're a Christian, are you looking? Are you seeing? Are you beholding your dignity to be a beloved child of God? So that's the first thing we have here, the Christian's dignity. Secondly, notice the Christian's discrepancy. The Christian's discrepancy. John continues there in that first verse by commenting that the world does not know us. The world does not know us. What he means by that is this. It's not, we're not characterized by such conspicuous levels of health and wealth and beauty and talent and success that as we walk down the street, people turn their heads and look at us and stop us and say, whoa, who are you? You must be someone famous. You must be someone special. And you say, oh, actually, yes, I'm a child of God, you know. Doesn't happen like that, does it? We're not characterized by conspicuous levels of health and wealth and all the rest of it. No, our lives are marked by just the same struggles and frustrations and disappointments as everyone else's. We're children of God, and yet there's nothing about the conditions we exist in that particularly suggests we are princes and princesses. We are sons and daughters of Almighty God. And so there's this discrepancy. You know what that word discrepancy means? A mismatch. Discrepancy is when two things then don't correspond. In the election campaign over the next few weeks, the main parties will be pointing to lots of discrepancies, won't they? The Labour Party will be pointing to discrepancies between what the Conservatives promised 5 years ago and what they've actually delivered. And the Conservatives will point to discrepancies between the amount of money Labour is promising to spend and the amount of money that's actually there to be spent. And there'll be all these discrepancies then being thrown around. And the discrepancy we're talking about here then is this, that in our status, we are children of God. And yet our conditions are so lowly, so unimpressive, so modest, so humble. That's the discrepancy that John is pointing to. And just a couple of quick points in connection with this before we move on. First of all, we shouldn't attempt to lessen this discrepancy. We shouldn't attempt to lessen this discrepancy. On the one hand, to lessen it by concluding that we should be healthy and wealthy and beautiful and talented and successful now because we're children of God. And of course, that is a route that many, many so-called Christians go down, isn't it? That if you're a child of God, then your health should be perfect. And you should have loads of money. And you should be successful in everything you touch. But no, John is clear here. The world doesn't know us. We're not to be characterized by those things. So we mustn't try to lessen the discrepancy in that direction. But then again, we mustn't try to lessen the discrepancy by concluding that obviously we're not fully children of God yet. If we live in such lowly circumstances, if our lives are so ordinary, then we can't be fully children of God yet. Now, John is quite emphatic about that. Verse 2, beloved, we are God's children now. You see, just as I said a few minutes ago, that the dignity of being in God's image belongs to every human being, even when that human being is addicted to heroin or whatever. So the dignity of being a child of God belongs to every Christian, even when that Christian is emaciated by some physical disease, befuddled by some mental illness, humbled through the loss of economic independence and the onset of redundancy. The dignity doesn't change a single bit. We are God's children now, whatever our circumstances, whatever our situation. If we are believers in Jesus Christ, we are God's children now. So that's the first thing. We mustn't try to lessen the discrepancy. And then the second point here is that this discrepancy has a precedent. John tells us that, doesn't he? It has a precedent. He says there in verse 1, the reason why the world does not know us is that it did not know him. In other words, John is saying the reason that we are unrecognizable as children of God in all the lowliness of our circumstances is because someone else was unrecognizable as a child of God in all the lowliness of his circumstances. Who? The child of God, the Son of God, the eternal Son, Jesus, during the entirety of his earthly existence. The same discrepancy was there, wasn't it? It was there throughout those 9 months that he spent in the womb of the Virgin Mary. He's the Son of God. And yet he's this fragile, developing little embryo. It's there in his birth. He's the Son of God. And yet he's a baby, helpless and crying, unable to talk, utterly dependent upon his mother. It's there in his childhood. He's the Son of God, and yet he lives in Nazareth of all places, the most dilapidated and run-down town, it seems, in the whole land. It's there in his public ministry. He's the Son of God, and yet he has nowhere to lay his head. And he's starving in the desert. And he's only in his early 30s, and yet it seems he already looks like he's 50 from the comments of his enemies. It's there at Golgotha. He's the Son of God. And yet he's nailed to a cross and he's in anguish and he's struggling for his very next breath and he's tormented in all kinds of ways. It's there in his burial. He's the Son of God and yet his body is mangled and bloodied and unrecognizable and grotesque, a lifeless heap being laid out in an old, dark, damp cave. This discrepancy has a precedent. Jesus, his status, the Son of God, his condition, so lowly, so unimpressive. John is saying, don't be surprised. This is authentic child of God existence. It's the existence that Jesus knew. It's the existence that you also inevitably will know. So the Christian's dignity, the Christian's discrepancy. Thirdly this evening, the Christian's destiny. The Christian's destiny. Because John then says, doesn't he, in verse 2, we know that when he appears, we shall be like him. Now the he here is again the Lord Jesus Christ. And John then is here assuming something. Something which is so obvious, he doesn't feel he needs to state it to his readers. He's assuming that in Jesus' case, the discrepancy has now been straightened out. The discrepancy has now been removed. And that, of course, is so central to what we're thinking about on Easter Sunday, isn't it? In that complex of events, beginning with the Easter Sunday morning resurrection and culminating in the enthronement at God's right hand several weeks later, in that complex of events, the discrepancy was straightened out. The mismatch disappeared, so that now Jesus' status as the Son of God matches his condition. Now he's glorious. Now he's impressive. Now he's majestic. That's what John is assuming here. What he's stating here is that one day exactly the same will happen to all God's children. It's our destiny, he's saying. Our destiny is that we are going to be like him. In other words, we too are finally going to experience the discrepancy straightened out. We too are finally going to exist in conditions that match our status as the sons of God. Our bodily conditions, our environmental conditions, our entire set of circumstances will one day match the underlying reality that we are God's children. It's interesting the logic that John uses as he explains this, isn't it? He says that this is going to happen because we shall see him. So he says, when he appears, we shall be like him because we shall see him as he is. What exactly is this logic here? Well, I think it's probably connected to a verse that we read earlier in our service in Romans chapter 8. Romans 8, 29. Paul says, remember, that those God foreknew he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. So it's the idea there that we are going to be conformed to Jesus' image in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. In other words, so that on the day we finally meet our elder brother, Jesus, there won't be this odd situation whereby he is unrecognizable from the rest of his family because he's glorious and stunning and we're all dilapidated. No, on the day we finally meet our elder brother, there will be a consistency between his appearance, his conditions, and our appearance, our conditions. Those of you who have been to my parents' house will have seen perhaps some of the photos that are up on the wall, somewhat embarrassingly. And there's a photo then from one of the family weddings where the three of us lads are standing in a line, and you can tell then from the picture whose wedding it is, because he's in the middle and he's dressed a little bit more smartly than the other two. But of course the other two of us are also dressed smartly. It would be very bizarre if the bridegroom was dressed in his suit and all the rest of it and we were there in jeans and t-shirts alongside him. And that then is the logic here. When Jesus and his brothers finally come together, it would be bizarre if Jesus is glorious and we are dilapidated and in an impoverished condition. But the point then of this verse is that our transformation isn't necessary yet because that coming together hasn't happened yet. We haven't had the reunion yet with our elder brother. He hasn't appeared yet. He's going to appear, John says. That's talking about his return to this earth at the end of history. He's going to appear. And then there will be this coming together of elder brother and all the rest of the family. But at the minute, that's not the case. At the minute, we don't see him. At the minute, there's distance. He's in heaven. We're on earth. And so the transformation into his likeness isn't necessary yet. Just as me and my brother who weren't getting married that day didn't need to be smart when we were sitting at breakfast because the wedding hadn't happened yet and we weren't going to be standing in any photos yet alongside the bridegroom. And so it's only when he appears and finally we will see him and there will be this union, this coming together of the whole family, it's only then that the transformation will be necessary. So this is our destiny then, if we're Christians this evening. Our destiny is that our very conditions, bodily and environmental, will one day match our status as the children of God. We will look like what we are. We are God's children now, but we don't look like it. There's nothing about us particularly that suggests it. But then we will be unveiled as who we really are before angels and men. What a day, what a prospect. The Christian's destiny. Fourthly and finally, the Christian's delay. The Christian's delay. So we don't know when this will be, do we? We don't know when this destiny will finally materialize. Might not be today. Might not be tomorrow. Might not be this year. It might not be in our lifetimes. There may be a considerable delay yet before this happens and he appears and we become like him. What are we to do then with this delay? Well, of course, there's nothing we can do to engineer ourselves this transformation into the physical likeness of Jesus Christ. There's nothing we can do ourselves to straighten out this discrepancy between our status and our conditions. In fact, all we can do is watch that discrepancy become more and more pronounced as we go through life and as we age and as our bodies erode and decline. All we can do is watch our bodies, as Paul puts it, fade away and the discrepancy become more and more glaring. There's nothing we can do to bring about ourselves this transformation into the physical likeness of Jesus Christ. But John says in our passage that there's something else we can do. We can bring about now a different sort of likeness to Jesus. A moral likeness to Jesus. A likeness to Jesus in our characters. As he puts it there in verse 3, we can purify ourselves as he is pure. And this actually is an important test, I think. You know how these suicide bombers, these Islamic jihadists, how they have then this hope, don't they, of a paradise with all these sensual pleasures, all these virgins at their disposal, and all the rest of it. It's a crassly materialistic hope that drives them in what they do. And I guess theoretically there's the danger that we could be like that as Christians. That we could want the resurrection purely because of the inherent value of having resurrection bodies, of being made new and living in a sparkling, pristine new universe, and all the rest of it. But this is the thing. The true believer wants a resurrection body. Yes, partly, of course, because it's a thrilling prospect in and of itself. But supremely, because he wants to be like Jesus. He wants a resurrection body because Jesus has got a resurrection body and he wants to be like Jesus. It's like the child who is wanting for Christmas a Manchester United football strip or a Newcastle United strip or a Barcelona strip or whatever. Why? Well, yes, partly because he likes the colours of the strip itself. But that's not the real reason. It's because he idolizes the men who at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon run out of the tunnel wearing that strip, and he wants to look like Wayne Rooney or whoever it might be. And even if actually the colors were changed one season, were completely different, no longer black and white for Newcastle or whatever. He'd still want it because he wants to look like those heroes. And that's what I'm talking about. Or to bring the illustration even closer to the point. Why was Fraser crying this afternoon? Because he had trousers on when his elder brother had shorts on. And he wanted to be like his elder brother. And is that not then why we should want resurrection bodies? Because we idolize Jesus Christ. Because we adore him. He's our hero. And if that's what he has, that's what we want. But you see, if we want to be like Jesus, then we want to be like Jesus across the board. And yes, that means we want a resurrection body like his. But surely it also means we want a character like his. Because Jesus is pure, John says. Jesus is beautiful in his character, not only now in his glorified resurrection body, but in his character he's beautiful. He's so gentle. He's so holy. He's so loving. He's so sin-hating. He's so generous. He's so kind. He's so wise in his decisions. And if we want to be like Jesus, then if we truly want resurrection bodies for the right reason, we will want to be like Jesus in every way, including our characters. And so we will go about the business of purifying ourselves. It's not, of course, the whole truth of the biblical doctrine of purification. We know, don't we, that God ultimately does purify us if we are true Christians. May God himself sanctify you, purify you, if you like, through and through. 1 Thessalonians 5:24. But that doesn't exempt us from doing anything. And here the emphasis is entirely on our self-purifying efforts. Are you busy about that project this evening? The project of purifying yourself. Does that consume your energy each day? I must purify myself. I want to purify myself. I want to be like Jesus. And I can't be like Jesus yet in my body. One day I will be. But I can be more and more like Jesus now in my very character. May God give us that desire, that aspiration, and help us in the business of self-purification.